Okay, I'm sure we can start now. We can start all over again. You see, this the sausage can be eaten at night too, so it's not only for the morning. Especially the one with donkey meat.
I not.
Okay, department, it's all yours. You'll decide how you handle it. But before we go on that. There seems to be a question that has been forgotten, so that you can input it into the question, because some of the members are going to leave early. Okay, Mabi.
Thank you very much, Chair. The department, there are so many regulations that have been put in place since 1994. There is a regulation particularly on tobacco. Have those regulations ever been evaluated?
Thank you very much, Abis. Maybe this is something that we asked, but we knocked at the wrong door yesterday. Because we started with MRC, but we thought about that question after. Umabi is very right, and the question is, if you do something, and I think the present government has actually been blamed on that, that they've got good policies, they've got good strategies, but they lack on monitoring and implementing. Now, the question is, there was a law that was passed, and there were regulations. Now, we see the department talks about regulating again. Have we looked at, when we regulated, how many people died of tobacco? I mean, was it the same before? Had it improved? So that we can say, if there was no improvement, then let's re-regulate. Now, I think that is the question. We tried to ask it yesterday, but we asked it, and what answer? We asked NHLS, but NHLS said, no, you should have asked MRC. MRC was gone by that time. So it was an interesting question, the question that is coming. Okay, you can go on to all the questions.
Yeah, thank you very much, and I'd like to thank the honourable members for both the comments and the questions. And thank you also for acknowledging progress where we've made some progress. So by consensus by my colleagues, we've agreed that I will give a comprehensive response to as many questions as I can, and then I'll ask each of my colleagues to comment or input further. So, Chair, let me just start with the issues you raised about the public entities. So let me start with some issues around the public entities. The department, as I think the Honourable Chair and members know, has a unit in the department that oversees public entities. And Shorty, who is sitting at the back there, is the director of public entities. And what we are trying to do in with respect to oversight over the public entities are really two things. One is that at the operational level, we have fairly good working relationships with them. And then on the governance and oversight relationship, she's responsible, together with her chief director and DDG, on governance issues and monitoring expenditure. So we've split in the department these two functions so that there's no conflict of interest. So I'll give you one example. For NHLS, for example, much of what NHLS does relates to HIV, TB, and the program. So I meet with NHLS to ensure that at the operational level, the turnaround times and all of that.
That's one message, because it keeps on going on. Or you fire nobody.
No, we can't fire. She's very new. She needs to outlast me, so we definitely can't fire her. And, so, So we split the functions to ensure that a different unit in the department is responsible for oversight of governance, and a different unit in the department relates to these entities on an operational level. And I've just used the NHLS as an example. It's a similar kind of relationship with the MRC. With respect to the MRC and providing evidence, I think that's an important observation you made, Chair, that they are, you know, they together with the HSRC, the Medical Research Council on the medical side and the HSRC on the more social and behavioral side, are two very important entities for government to use, together with Stats South Africa, to collect data that that should provide the evidence for whether things are working or things are not working. I think whether we're making a difference or whether we're not making a difference. And we've been using the MRC and the HSRC in that way as well. So the MRC, for example, has done for two successive years our antenatal, our prevention of mother to child transmission surveys. You know, so it's independent, independently done surveys to look at the transmission of HIV from mothers to children. And we fund the MRC together with the Centers for Disease Control to do that. We have funded the HSRC to do two surveys, the results of which should be available later this year. The one is called the South African Health and Nutrition Survey, which is looking specifically at the non-communicable diseases. Because, you know, we know that that's a growing problem, and we're going to have an epidemic of non-communicable diseases if we don't do the right things, like eat the right things, exercise, not smoke, not drink, all of those things. So those results will be available, we hope, in the next few months. And the other survey they're doing will give us a better handle at a population level on infant, under five, neonatal, and maternal mortality. Because I think honorable members do know that besides this rapid review that the MRC did, which the COO told us about in a presentation, the last demographic and health survey that was done in 2003. And the one before that was done in 1998. We hope that the results that they give us on the survey they're doing will give us a better sense at the population level, the community level, on what the mortality rates are. So we use the HSRC and the MRC, and that's the point I'm making, to evaluate what progress we're making, because they are independent, but they are public entities that are supposed to support government together with Stats South Africa. Now, with respect to Stats South Africa and the release recently of their burden of disease study, that was 2010 data. I think that's the first point to make. That already is a bit old, but of course, it's still very useful information. Secondly, I think the important point to make is that the data that they generate comes from death certificates. As you know, we have been improving the way in which death certificates are written because of the training we've been doing together with Home Affairs of the doctors who fill in the death certificates. But they're still not perfect. So it's death certificate data and it's 2010 data. And of course you have to rely completely, because there's no way of doing significant verification, on what the doctor fills in as the cause of death. But they also fill in the underlying cause of death. So we've been trying to figure out how to link these two things. You know, the cause of death, the immediate cause of death, and the underlying cause of death. So the issue of TB being the major cause of death, what we do know is that the HIV epidemic is also driving the TB epidemic. We have at least a 60% co-infection rate of HIV, people with HIV also having TB, which means that people with HIV need to be protected from getting TB. So that's a big thing. But as the chair also commented, we know that TB has been around for millennia, you know, since antiquity. So it's not a new disease. And we also know that it's a disease of poverty. So we need to, as a society, as a whole of government respond to it. Now, with respect to the TB in the mind, which many members have commented on, it's a big problem. The prevalence of TB in the mind is about 7 times higher than TB in the general population. And the highest rates of TB in the mines you will find in the gold mines. And the reason for that is that our gold mines are very old mines, and they're very deep, and they have a lot of dust, silica. So those are the major contributors, and of course the associated contributors are nutrition, and as you know, many of the miners have complained about poor nutrition on the mines, and poor housing. And historically, as you know, we've had both single-sex hostels and very cramped accommodation on mines. The good news, if there is good news, is the following. One is that government, including the deputy president, has recognized the importance of dealing with TB on the mind. And as a consequence, you will recall, Honorable Chair, that 2 years ago, World TB Day was held on a mine in South Carltonville to ensure that we start accelerating, together with the mining companies and the unions, dealing with TB on the mines. And the Deputy President repeated that message on World TB Day this year, which was held in Oldmore Prison. So led by the Deputy President and SANAC, we are increasing our focus on TB on the mines. What's also true is that this has now reached proportions that are larger than just South Africa, because the minister has often said that, and we've been accused by our neighboring states of doing so, of exporting TB, that miners from other countries who come and work here get TB on the mines and then go home, and of course then spread TB at home. So we've got now a regional initiative led by the Stop TB Partnership and the World Bank. Together with the Minister of Health in Swaziland, our Minister of Health, and we are hoping to also include the Minister of Health of Lesotho at least, and Mozambique, to have a regional initiative that will do a few things. The first thing is to harmonize the treatment protocols across all these countries. So regardless of where you're getting treated for TB, you should be getting the same treatment. The second is to strengthen the referral system and to make it as simple as possible so that we can refer people who are starting treatment in South Africa when they go home to a specific clinic in Lesotho, Swaziland, or Mozambique. Thirdly, it's to ensure that we are able to trace families of miners who have TB. And the minister is quite clear that they must be traced regardless of which country they are in. So we have a series of activities that will culminate in a regional summit co-hosted by SADC, the World Bank, the Stop TB Partnership, and the ministers of the four countries, that is likely to be held either in late November or early December in South Africa. At that meeting, the idea is to announce the, not plans, but the concrete steps that have been taken and have been implemented to have a regional response for TB. In terms of funding for this response, the Global Fund has agreed to review a proposal for a regional TB set of activities. So we are in the process of putting together a proposal, a regional proposal on TB control, that relates largely to TB on the mines. But people migrate not just for mining, for the sake of mining. They cross our borders for many reasons. So we'll be looking at how to have a more comprehensive approach, but that includes a fairly significant mining component. So I think there's a lot of work being done to reduce it. We've also introduced this new technology called Gene Expert, you know, which we spoke about many times, I think, with this committee, in all the mines. And we hope that that would increase the case finding, that we will improve case finding. Now, the last thing I want to say about TB on the mines, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, is that we know also that many miners now are living in communities surrounding the mines. They don't always live on mine premises. So working with especially the big mines, we are looking at how to take the services provided in the mines to the surrounding communities. And we started that in Carltonville, Honorable Chair, if you recall. So much of the case finding was also around the communities, especially the informal communities around the mines. The big issue about the issues that I think the honourable members are raising is that with increasing industrialization, and we are seeing this with the with Eskom building new power plants, and this is mostly in rural areas, that we see a large an acceleration of communities developing around these mining these power plants and the coal mining areas in particular. So that's the next new hotspot for both TB and HIV. So we've agreed at an interministerial committee last week, which was chaired by the Deputy President, that whenever we have these new initiatives, especially these big infrastructure initiatives, we must, together with those tenders, have a process that will ensure that we mitigate the risks associated with development around those areas. So whether it's trucking, or whether it's commercial sex work, or whether it's informal settlements around it, we need to figure out how to protect them when we have people coming into rural areas from outside those areas for purpose of building the plant and then staff are dealing with that. With respect to consultants, we had a discussion about this and the AG's report with SCOPA, because they raised it as well. They invited the department together with other departments, and it was fairly clear that the view of Parliament, certainly as reflected by SCOPA and sounds like from this committee too, is that we should, as much as we might want to rely on consultants for some things, we must ensure that we build the capacity of the state to deliver these services, because that's the only way to sustain them. And I think that basic principle is acceptable to, I think, all of the people who were present at that meeting, and I'm sure all of us too. But there are areas where we would need some expert assistance for short periods of time, and for those things you can't have a person in the department to do it. So there will be a role for consultants, but we think it should be very specific. And taking the issue you raised about the skills left behind, Chair, is clearly something that we'll be working on. In terms of relationship with the private sector, I think the inclusion of the GPs, general practitioners, in the NHI is one example of how the department is thinking about bringing the private sector into the public space. And as you know, the minister has been going province by province, district by district, talking to GPs about their role, their future role in the NHI, for example. And what's fairly clear that within NHI, the National Health Insurance, you have to find a way of getting the public and private sectors to work together. I mean, you can't have two separate sectors in an NHI. So I think that provides another opportunity for having a closer working relationship. The issues you raised about SANEC, I think a few members raised issues about SANEC. I'd say you're absolutely right. SANEC was in the department. It was a program in the department, you will recall, that was run by a director in the department. But over time, especially given the concerns that civil society had at that time about the way that the department was running the HIV program, there was a decision to take SANEC outside of the department. But we had to find a vehicle to do that. So it's exactly as you explained it. We now have that vehicle, and the department is one of the stakeholders in SANEC. So there are many sectors, there are about 19 sectors in SANEC. Government is one sector, and within the government sector, the Department of Health is one role player. So, and SANEC has been restructured under the members as well. So it's been restructured in the following way. So it has a board with trustees, and they have their own bank account. So the monies that are transferred from us are transferred into that account now. Then, chaired by the deputy president and co-chaired by civil society, they have a plenary, which is a large stakeholder meeting that happens three or four times a year. As it turns out, the next one is this Friday in Secunda, which will be chaired by the Deputy President. And the idea is to take each of the plenary meetings into different provinces to hear from the Premier of that province how they're doing on TB and HIV. So the Premier of Mpumalanga will give the first presentation on Friday on how Mpumalanga is responding to the TB and HIV epidemic. The previous one we had was in KwaZulu-Natal. And then we have what's called the Program Review Committee, which is basically reviewing what SANEC does, what the various sectors in SANEC does. And we had one of those meetings 2 weeks ago, where we discussed a whole range of technical issues. But the idea is that all sectors should contribute to the effort to reduce new infections and to ensure that people are on treatment, both for TB and HIV and other STIs. So that's the idea. They have a new CEO, so I think it's right to call the new CEO to this committee to get him, as it turns out, him, to explain. And I think the chair knows the CEO to explain what they're doing. One of the mandates that the deputy president has given the SANEC secretariat is precisely what the honorable member from Northwest said, to strengthen the provincial AIDS council and the district AIDS council, because we know that the work will happen at that level far more than at the national level. As it turns out, Honourable Member, they did visit the Provincial AIDS Council in the Northwest. And I don't have to tell you about that Provincial AIDS Council. You know more about it than I do. But it's one of the best staffed Provincial AIDS Councils in the country. They've got about 60 people working there. And I think that's the reason you're raising it. So, but I think they've gone to the National Secretariat has gone to visit to look at how to strengthen, restructure, etc., etc. Especially the Northwest. They've also been to Limpopo and they've been to Mpumalanga. They're kind of visiting all of the provincial AIDS councils. and also the district aid council. With respect to, let me just finish the issues around HIV. The other issue around HIV was PEPFAR. As you may know, honorable members, currently the US government, through PEPFAR, provides the South African government, not the Department of Health, the whole of government, just under $500 million each year. And they've been doing it for the last 10 years. However, because of the economic situation in the US globally, and also because they think we are now a middle-income country, we are doing quite well, we should fund our own program, there's an agreement between the two governments that over the next 5 years, starting last year, the just under $500 million will decrease by half by 2017. Right? So, and that's quite a significant drop. Now the question is, where does the money go to? Some of the money goes to NGOs. Some of the money goes to different government departments. With respect to different government departments, the Department of Health is the majority shareholder. You know, is the biggest beneficiary. We've got an agreement with them that they will, over the next now 4 years, decrease funding for treatment of people with HIV, but continue focusing on providing technical assistance and focusing on prevention. So that's the agreement, which means then, Chair, that the government must take over funding patients that were treated using PEPFAR funding historically. So we've had a transition plan to ensure that patients are not dumped somewhere, that there's an orderly process of transitioning for the last 18 months or so. And bar some hiccups here and there, we think that the transition has happened largely well, but there are still pockets that we are managing the transition around. As it turns out, the Minister of Finance is in Washington, as you know, this week, and one of the issues he's discussing with the administration is PEPFAR funding. You will also have noted from the CFO's presentation that the Ministry of Finance has given us some additional money to compensate for the loss of some PEPFAR funding, both to the NHLS and to the department. So we're working quite carefully on how to do that. Let me just deal with the rest of the issues on TB and then move to maternal and child health and to some of the other administrative issues. With respect to TB, our treatment success rate at the moment is 78.9%. The target is 85%. So we're still far from the target. The problem, honorable members, there are some districts, and I'm afraid to say, honorable members, that one of the provinces with now the worst TB programs is the Northwest, and the other is the Northern Cape. And it's basically a problem of managing the program. If you don't have a good TB manager, TB control manager, you know, the program, and it's not just TB, it's any program and any facility. If you don't have a good manager, you know, we all struggle. So what we've been doing, honorable members, is from the national department going to each province, and in each province going to each district to evaluate what, with respect to TB, what the TB control program looks like in each district, what the challenges are, and then coming up with a recommendation to the provincial department of health in respect of how that TB program in that province can be strengthened. And we've been to the Northwest, and I went there as well, honorable members. There's some good things happening, but there are still quite a few challenges with respect to TB in that province. The minister has highlighted three groups that we need to focus on in particular, besides doing what we're doing for the general population. TB in children has been prioritized because the case finding of TB in children is difficult and we're not doing very well. Secondly, TB on the mines, which we've spoken about. And thirdly, TB in prisons. Again, the TB in prisons is very high, and there are good reasons for it, you know, in terms of poor infection control and the rest of it. And that's one of the reasons why the Deputy President hosted World TB Day at Portsmouth Prison on the 24th of March. So we have a program now to expand TB services and improve TB services in prisons. One of the key things, of course, is overcrowding in prisons. So we are working with the Department of Correctional Services to figure out what we do about the overcrowding. With respect to re-engineering of primary healthcare, I think, as honourable members know, that this is the foundation of our health system. We now have a new DDG for primary healthcare, Ms. Jeanette Hunter. So we're hoping that with the new DDG and with new energy and focus, that it would accelerate implementation. But the minister has, as you know, been talking about the three streams of primary healthcare engineering. So let me just say a little bit about each of those. With respect to the ward-based outreach team, our annual report will show that at the end of 2012-13, we've had about 500 teams in place. Now, as you know, we want at least one team in each municipal ward, and we have 4,000 of them. So we're nowhere near full coverage. And that's why the targets that have been set were as they were suggested by this by the COO. So the baseline that the Honourable Member asked about is 500 to move to 700. With respect to the school health system, you'll recall that in October last year, the President launched the school health program, the integrated school health program, which we developed jointly with the Department of Basic Education. That's currently being rolled out, and the National Department, with support from the European Union, has bought 30 mobiles, school mobiles, which have been deployed in the NHI pilot districts, and will be buying another 60 before the end of October, again to deploy. And those are also going to be focusing on the rural areas. So some of them are going to be 4x4 so that they can go into areas with poor road infrastructure. The ward-based outreach team, we also said, should be targeting the NHI pilot districts and also focusing on rural areas, because we know that rural areas have less access to our fixed facilities, which means we have to take the services to people. So the idea, Honourable Chair, is as far as possible to take services to people, both promotive and preventive and also minor curatives, rather than only expecting them to come to fixed facilities or putting fixed facilities in every possible place, because that's really not affordable, and in terms of the economies of scale is probably not the best thing. It's also probably not the best thing in terms of quality. So if you take deliveries, for example, we know if you don't do at least 100, between 100 and 150 deliveries a month, you shouldn't be doing deliveries. And we see that in the Free State in particular. So school health, we're doing quite well, I think. We've exceeded the 2012-13 target with respect to grade 1 in quintile 1 and 2. Where we're not doing very well is reaching the grade 8. So that's still a challenge in school health. With respect to the district clinical specialist teams, you will recall that we are putting 7 specialists, 4 doctors and 3 nurses in every district. Currently we have, in 34 districts, at least 3 of the 7 people. And in a few districts, we have all of them, all 7. But of course it's more difficult getting doctors and nurses to work there. But, Honourable Chair, we're already seeing the impact of these 3 programs. I'll give you one example. I went to visit OD Hospital. Some of you know where OD Hospital is in Gauteng. It's just outside Pretoria, last Friday. Yes. It used to belong to the Honourable Deswai, but now belongs to Gauteng. Yes, it used to be there. It used to be in Northwest. It's now in Gauteng. You will recall that in Jubilee, which is not far from the Jubilee Hospital, last year, 3 kids got burnt because they were in incubators that were poorly maintained. Since then, both Jubilee and OD have new incubators. If you go to OD Hospital, you will find the state-of-the-art newborn care unit. It'll be better than the private sector, guaranteed. And they've reduced, between 2010 and 2012, reduced neonatal mortality from between 7 and 8 a month between 1 and 3 a month. So they've actually turned that neonatal unit around in a fairly short period of time. So there are pockets of good things going on. We need to figure out how to make this go on everywhere. And that's where the facility improvement teams come in. Now, the COO said we're going to be expanding the number of districts where we have these facility improvement teams. Now, you will recall that over a 18-month period, through HSC and a consortium led by HSC, the Health Systems Trust, they went to every one of our facilities to do a facility audit on everything from package of services delivered through to infrastructure and human resources. So every facility now knows what their baseline looks like. So what the DG then did and the minister did was set up teams from the national department to go into these districts to then develop improvement plans for each of these districts, which means visiting facilities. Right? So people from the national department, which is all of us here, We've all got districts. So, Miss Rennie's district is Vembe. Right? I'm not sure why it's Vembe, but it's Vembe. So she's stuck with the poor boy, you know, where the administrator or whatever. Mine is Tswane, for example. So each one of us has a district. And we are supposed to lead a national team in these districts to show visible improvement. It's the issue you raised, Honorable Mesa. Right? How do you know that things are changing at facility level? So we've got now pictures. Our job is to go there, fix things, and show how it was and what it looks like now. So the idea is, and this also speaks to the issue of how we're working in the provinces. And the issue you raised, Honorable Chair, that much of the money goes to provinces, that's where the implementation is. So historically, we had a hands-off approach, as you know. We provided the guidelines, the policies, the legislation, and we expected the provinces then to do it. Now, we think that we should help the provinces a bit more to do it, which means going into these districts, going into the facilities, and changing things, together with our provincial counterparts. I mean, we're not doing it alone. And you know, if I think at some point, it would be good to call the department back to get a report on what these FITS teams have done to date. And also what some of the continuing challenges are, because it's not, you know, it's not all fixed, you know. So that's what the these FITS teams have been doing, and that's what the primary healthcare reengineering is trying to do. And we are indeed trying to focus far more on the rural areas, but there are significant challenges in the rural areas, as you know, you know, and they will stay with us for a while until we have a more robust program, a whole-of-government approach to a rural to rural areas. It can't be done department by department. You must see the entire government approach to it. With respect to maternal and child health, as the CEO reported, and as the Honourable Member mentioned from the Confidential Inquiries Committee, we, for maternal health, we are seeing a fairly significant reduction in institutional mortality. That is the mortality of people dying in our hospitals. And the major reason for that is our HIV program. So the more women that either don't have HIV or are treated early for HIV, the less likely they are to die in childbirth. So that's one of the key things. But as you know, there are other causes of maternal mortality too. So obstetric hemorrhage, bleeding after delivery, is a big problem. And we now have a whole team training midwives and doctors on the essential steps in the management of obstetric emergencies. And we're starting with the 25 worst districts. And within that 25, there's the 12 that are worse than everybody else. So since June last year, we've been training doctors and midwives in ESMO, it's called ESMO. So we think that that's an intervention that will save a large number of lives. Then there's also hypertension related to pregnancy. That's also a major cause of mortality. There are a few other causes, but those are like the major causes of mortality. So we're working with each of these causes of mortality to target both geographic areas and specific causes of mortality to reduce them. What we don't know, and we'll only know after the HSRC gives us the survey results, is what the mortality in communities are. Right? Because when after mothers leave hospital, they go home. You know? And we need to know also whether they're dying after delivery, post-discharge from hospital. But there are a number of things we're doing to improve it. Now, the district clinical specialist team's role is specifically to work with every facility and every district to ensure a decrease in infant, child, and maternal mortality. That's the role of these seven people we are putting in each district. Together with, of course, the district management team and the primary healthcare folks. That's the rationale for putting these teams in. So we should be, we think we've got all the right interventions in place. We now need to measure the impact of these interventions. The issue of under five mortality. The major causes of under-5 mortality are in this order: HIV, 40% of under-5 mortality is HIV-related. Then the other causes are pneumonia, diarrhea, severe malnutrition, and slowly increasing is TB. Now, with respect to HIV, the better our prevention of mother-to-child transmission is, the lower our mortality will be from HIV for under-5. With respect to diarrhea and pneumonia, as you know, we've introduced in 2008 two new vaccines for pneumonia and diarrhea. The NHLS has been monitoring. You're asking about how we're monitoring some of the things we're doing. We asked them to monitor the impact of these two new vaccines. And what they tell us, through the surveillance they're doing, is each of these vaccines has reduced under five mortality, each of them, by 5% since its introduction. And that's at a coverage of about 80%. We've got about 80%, but at the moment we've got about 90% coverage. But at 80% coverage, the reduction is 5% for each of those. So the results of the MRC presented on decline of under five mortality is contributed by the HIV program and these two new vaccines largely. Where we've not done very well is severe malnutrition. Right? So that's something we need to really focus on, especially in rural areas. So that's something we need to do better on and more on, together with the Department of Agriculture and other government departments, clearly. The challenge we still have, as the CEO said in her presentation, is neonatal mortality. That's mortality in the first 28 days after delivery. There it's a bit stuck at 14 per thousand, and our target by 2014 is 12. So we have a package of intervention that we are implementing to reduce neonatal mortality. Now what we've done, Chair, is that we've sent letters to each hospital CEO, and we've copied the district manager and the district clinical specialist team. And I'll give you a copy of this letter for each facility. And each letter says, these are the mortality rates for the country against the MDG targets. So this is how far the country is from the MDG targets. This is what's happening at the provincial level, and this is what's happening in your institution. We then give them a list from the three ministerial committees of the major causes of mortality and what should be done to decrease mortality. And we give them a way of setting their own targets. So we are hoping then the district clinical specialist team will work with each institution using this data to set targets and to put the right interventions in place facility by facility to reduce the infant, neonatal, under five and maternal mortality. And we'll give you copies of the letters, especially those that relate to your constituency. You know, so when you go to those facilities, you can take the letter with you and say, well, this is the data. Tell us what you're doing about it, you know, then in terms of accountability. But that will certainly help us, you know. So that's why I'm saying, you know, I think with respect to the minister's re-engineering of primary health care, even though the implementation is not complete, because it's a big project, and with these specific interventions that are program related, we're doing all the right things. You know, what we need are two things: get full coverage, which is I think one of the things that the members mentioned, and good quality. You know, those are the two critical things we need to get, so that we can show that the numbers are coming down more steeply, faster. So let me turn now to. I think I've spoken for far too long. Let me ask my colleagues to add, and I'll start with Tiny, because we have some HR related issues as well.
Thank you, Dr.
Pillay.
Good evening, honorable members. I will respond to the questions related to vacancy rates. The simple question is, yes, we do have vacancies, and the precise response is that we are at 8.4%. Members will note that last year when we presented, we were at 25% vacancy rate. Now we are at 8.4, mainly also because of the personal cleanup process and the fact that we are now implementing the new organizational structure. And I also need to indicate that with the current available funds for the current financial year, we have prioritized to focus on the Office of Standards Compliance, the Provincial Support Unit, and primary health care. Other posts are sporadic around the entire department, but these are the main focus areas. Lastly, to indicate also that over and above this vacancy rate or these new posts that we'll be filling the for the current year, which is 50 posts, if you look at page 28, of the APP, the department is hiring 371 what we now call interns. the ones that we appointed last year to assist the provinces with turning around the audit findings. So their term expires end of this month, but from the 1st of May, we take them on for 2 years as contract employees. So we're going to appoint them now as contract employees for Department of Health, but we will second them back to the provinces to continue with the work that they've been doing for audit purposes. Thank you, Chair. I don't know if I missed anything. On the issue of the vaccines, okay, members would have noticed in the media reports that, unfortunately, we had two conflicting reports. The fact of the matter is that it was evident enough that we do have the vaccines at the depot. The information I have is that there was an internal, I'm looking for a proper word, poor management, that's the word, because the distribution contract, remember that we get contractors or manufacturers supplying to the depot, and then we now have to distribute to the hospitals and the clinics. Now, the distribution is done by somebody else. It's some service providers that have been appointed on contract basis. So their contract expired end of March, and there was a delay in bringing in new people or extending their contract. So it only reached the office of the HOD yesterday. So that is why there was that lag of the fact that the medication is at the depot, but it's not at the clinic. But that matter has been resolved today. Those people, as we speak, are busy distributing the medication to the clinic. So, and unfortunately, the MEC did not have that detailed briefing before he went to the media, unfortunately. So by the time the minister went to the media, we already had the detailed information, and that's what he has. And the issue of funding that the MEC talked about, it was true last year, November. Last year, November, we did have problems with the funding, but during the adjustment budget, the problem was resolved. And that is why we were able to shift money around and then get approval from Treasury, get an adjustment budget, and procure so that for the current month, which is the first month of the new financial year, we have stock at the depot. So, unfortunately, that's how it came out in the media. It was resolved. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. There was a question from one of the honourable members around the format of the annual performance plan. There is guidelines that are provided by Treasury that we all adhere to. And in terms of production of the APP, we did submit to honourable members a copy of the APP, which follows the format that indicates vision, mission, strategic goals, the situational analysis, and the detailed information on the programs, including the budget. For purposes of our presentation today, because of the level of detail that is contained into this document, we had to leave strategic issues. And when I started with the presentation, I said, honorable members, we will provide a strategic context that covers the vision mission, including the alignment of the key priority areas. And we then focused on key areas. And those key areas were mainly centered around the negotiated service delivery agreement. So in terms of the presentation, we did not follow the format as prescribed by Treasury, but we wanted the presentation to be more accessible to honorable members. So hence the departure from the format that is actually outlined in the document that we distributed to honorable members. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. There was a question about the evaluation and impact of regulations on tobacco control regulations in the country. Maybe first to premise my response by saying a lot of these regulations, specifically these tobacco regulations, we take them on board generally after there has been evidence from other countries that they will be effective. There have been countries that have been a little ahead of us in terms of piloting some of the more controversial aspects of the tobacco regulations. I'm sure honorable members would have seen on international newspapers court cases in Uruguay, India, Australia, Sweden, being taken to court and incidentally winning all those cases against tobacco companies. So in South Africa specifically, we've got very, very good evidence of the impact of these regulations that came out of the Youth Behavioral Survey, which showed a very significant decline in the use of tobacco, specifically by youth. And we've tried to strengthen these because they've got a direct bearing on TB. And if TB is one of our focus areas in disease control, we think that the tobacco regulations have helped to a great extent to deal with TB and TB infection. Chair, the next coming batch of regulations, and I have to say, yes, there are regulations coming already that we are still working on. One of the things I have to mention is that being signatories, and by coincidence, I don't know why today I have appeared from COP, the FCTC, Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. It's just a drafting bill. I don't know why I had it today. Being signatories to this convention, we are bound by the dictates of the convention to take certain steps to control tobacco. So even if it was not our own initiative or our own interest, and that came out of our own circumstances to try to deal with tobacco, we would have been bound anyway by our commitment to the framework convention, the WHO framework convention to do tobacco control regulations. And one of the things that the WHO, and in fact the UN system in general, does is to assess exactly what we're talking about, to assess how far countries are moving towards meeting what they've committed to themselves, to meet in terms of tobacco control. And though there are no kudos given for those who meet, but there are very subtle punishments for those that don't meet. I mean, it's not in the law, but it's a social thing that is done. One of the examples that we always find very interesting is that when South Africa hosted the Conference of Parties, COP3, 4 years ago, actually, that spot was supposed to be taken by Switzerland. But when the assessors came and looked at how far South Africa had gone in terms of tobacco control and how far Switzerland had gone, it was immediately switched to South Africa. So when the two countries were competing, South Africa was given the honor of hosting COP3. So as I say, there's no law or regulation that forces people, but there are some social measures that countries suffer. And one of the things that put countries on the maps is hosting these big international conferences that give a name and a face to a country. And usually things like that, how far you comply with your commitments globally, counts a lot. And that is why we have to make sure that we do keep up. We are not the first to lead on some of these regulations, which we find a bit controversial. But we do take the cue from those that go first and see how they fare legally when there's a legal challenge, and then we come in and pilot. And we do have piloted, and yes, we do have evidence. Thank you.
Honourable Chair, with regard to the question or the request by Honourable Member Deswai that she needs a breakdown of the ward-based outreach teams per ward, per district, we will send that to this committee through the parliamentary officer from the department, Mr. Khatla. Thank you.
Thank you. One of the questions that was asked that I think we omitted to respond to is the organogram alignment issue that the Honourable Member from Northwest asked. So Tiny, there's a project that Tiny would, that Ms. Fanny would speak to briefly.
I'm sorry, but I'm sorry, one question here. So if you go to the ground,
not from you anymore, Chair, and yes, old and Adele, thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. The question was the issue related to the new organogram and why don't we align with the provinces, our counterparts. The response to that is that, yes, we have the new organogram in 2010. Then in 2011, we started the process of engaging the provinces to align their organograms with the national one. For instance, the Limpopo one has already been done. It's just waiting to go through processes of approval. But the issue specifically that the member was referring to are the levels of manager at district level. With that one, our response to that at national level will be the current project that we're busy partnering with WHO, yes, on the development of the nonsense standards and staffing ratios. So they have done all the provinces in terms of piloting. So we piloted at an NHI pilot site, and they have developed the nonsense standards for those areas, but collectively with the province, so that the province takes ownership of the process. So the outcome is going to be presented to National Health Council for adoption. Once it is adopted, the provinces are going to implement for uniformity and standardization. So you will have a district manager at the same level across all provinces, or a sub-district manager or a facility manager. All of those will be uniform once that process is completed. Thank you, Chair.
Are you already done?
Yes, sir. Is you still thinking about NHLS, Chair?
Yes.
Chair, a couple of things I didn't answer. I thought I'll just come back to it very quickly. TB and how we're involving communities, the Honourable Member asked about that. And this is basically taking the form of case finding in communities. We had a project that started at World TB Day 3 years ago, starting in the hotspot areas, of going into households to do both screening for HIV and testing for TB. And that's the idea, is to kind of go out and look for cases in communities and also to increase our contact tracing. With respect to medical male circumcision, you know, the WHO is almost ready to pre-authorize a device called PREPEX, which has been underwent clinical trials in Zimbabwe, Rwanda, and one other country, Uganda, I think. So as soon as they pre-qualify this device, it's a ring, we will then consider using it. The ministers, we already sent a group to Rwanda to look at the use of this particular device, but we're waiting for the WHO to pre-qualify it, because that's the only way to massify it, but to do it safely. I think that the chair answered the traditional versus the medical issue. I won't go into that. With respect to karma, I'm not sure if I mentioned it, but we'll be jointly with the African Union hosting a review of the implementation of karma on the whole continent in August this year. And it's going to be championed by our own former Minister of Health and Foreign Affairs and Home Affairs, Dr. Nkosazana Zuma. So between the 1st and the 3rd, and I'm sure the minister will send an invitation to the honourable members to that continental meeting between the 1st and the 3rd of August. With respect to contraception, as honourable members may know, we've adopted a new contraception and fertility policy, and we are currently in the process of implementing it. There's a couple of new things in that policy. One is that we are increasing the training and the number of IUDs that women can have inserted should they wish to use intrauterine devices as a contraceptive. And the next one is implants, contraceptive implants. We are just waiting for one more product to be registered with the MCC before we go out on tender. So the idea is to expand the method mix, you know, to ensure that women have as many choices as possible. And at the moment, as you know, they have condoms, male and female condoms, the pill. Then there's the injections, injectables, and then there's the IUDs, and now we're going to introduce the fifth one, which is the implants. So that's the idea. And of course, we now have trained a large number of people on the IUD insertion and removal, and we'll do the same with the implants. On the issue of condoms, as I think we will also show in our annual report, Honourable Chair, we've not reached our 1 billion target for male condoms. And it's largely a supply problem. It's not a money problem. There just aren't enough supplies globally to get this many condoms through our tender system. So we are working with the UNFPA, United Nations Family Planning Unit, to see if we can't buy condoms off their tender, you know, because they go on a global tender. But we have to also comply with our own rules for tenders and all of that. But there's a possibility of buying 500 million male condoms off the UNFPA tender. So we might well significantly increase male condoms. And we have, through donations again from UNFPA, increased the number of female condoms we've distributed fairly significantly, but the numbers are still very far apart between male and female condoms. I think I'll stop there, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And the gateway?
Yes, the gateways. Honourable Member, the gateway clinic idea is quite an old one. Many facilities have gateway clinics, right? Many of them. For example, I'll give you one example. In Pretoria, there's a Steve Biko Hospital, which is a tertiary hospital. Next to it is the district hospital, and the district hospital has a gateway clinic. So there's quite a few, but not all hospitals have gateway clinics. I fully agree. So, for example, one of the complaints when we went to Odi was that people bypass, especially given what the chair said, they bypass all the clinics in that area and go to Odi Hospital. Right? And Mankweng is the same problem.
Yes.
And the chair is right. People bypass for many reasons. Right? Either they think the quality of service is not good, or they don't have enough drugs at the primary health care level, or they want to see a doctor. And that's why the minister insists that we put doctors, as part of the NHI, into the primary health care facility. Not to see everyone, because then, you know, the nurses are well trained, the primary health care nurses, so they will then refer to the GPs that go there. But in order to do that, we need to ensure that our facilities have enough consulting rooms for the doctors to consult in and have all the equipment. So the idea in putting in these 550-odd GPs in the next financial year into primary health care is to ensure, firstly, the infrastructure is ready for them and all the equipment they need is in place. But that's precisely why the minister thinks we should get our GPs, even if they do sessions in our facility, at least then our patients will be able to see a doctor, should they need it, at a primary health care facility. That would also increase patient satisfaction, maybe improve patient outcomes, but also decrease the load on our district hospitals.
Thank you. I don't think we need to question you further. Maybe we'll just round up by saying when you present to us your annual business plan, you are telling us what you want to do with the money that they are requesting us to make. And then it depends on us whether we're hopeful that you will be able to handle that money. With your explanations, I must say we have got hope that you will do. So come the 15th, we'll try and pass the budget, hoping that you are going to do the things that you are going to do. And we will definitely give you that money. There was somebody from USA who is coming from the Consul General. She left a message, I'm going to be meeting here. I think we're just going to be talking about HEFA. I'm going to arrange that meeting. So I'll meet her. She invited me that to meet. It's a lady, by the way.
I can also do comedy.
I don't need that. I think this confusion about Limpopo and the vaccines. I think we'll try and see if we can afford to send two members of parliament just to go and check for ourselves and say, no, this is the situation. Because when there are conflicting ideas, so you never know which one is right. But we'll try and do that. But if we can't, we will tell you. Okay, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, Chairperson, I know it's not my area. I shouldn't say anything in that regard based on your recommendation. But maybe just to indicate that the NCOP, as we speak, is in the province. So maybe if Chair can coordinate with those that are down there already. They will be there until the 19th. Yes, that's the health committee. Yes. No, it's the head NCOP for the entire province. So we are sitting with them. The last meeting is on Friday, the 19th. So, yeah, in the morning.
Okay.
So maybe you can
we'll talk to them.
Yes.
About the regulations, you know what usually happens? I think the laws are made by Parliament and the regulations by Parliament too, but it's by delegation that they go to the department. So that's where the interest is that when we do some of these things, we consider a lot of things. We've got to look at the tractor. I was talking to somebody there who were being invited to go to Malawi. And in fact, then I heard later, which is what they were trying to say, that if Malawi could regulate tobacco, they wouldn't have a government. That's what they were saying. They were inviting us to go and see what's going on there. But that is not the issue now. The issue is just to sit down and see all this statistics that we've got and look at our country broadly. Fortunately, most of the members of Parliament don't smoke. They don't smoke. They don't like smoking. Some of them, they run away from smoking. So all we are interested, because the reason we're here is to look at the interests of the country. I always think of a drug. You know, if I take a Panadol, there's a possibility that I can have renal failure or liver failure because of that Panadol. But what I do, I weigh the consequences that can happen and the benefit that it can do. So I think even in these other things, everything has got a negative, has got a positive. You balance those positive and negatives and say, this is how I go for the present situation. Because countries are asymmetrical. They are asymmetrical. We can't benchmark ourselves with England. Neither can we benchmark ourselves with Zimbabwe. We are our own. We've got our own challenges. Now we've got to look at our own challenges. Even if somebody who comes from somewhere says, do this, we've got to sit down and say, okay, they say we must do this, but what is our situation? I think it's on that basis that we say, maybe we need to meet the department at a certain time and talk about it. Because the last time that we met, the people that came were not very eloquent and convincing in what they told us. So we would need some time. It might be next semester where we would call you and sit down and look at those regulations. But we're very hopeful. We think that come the 15th and I'm just trying to look at the members. I think all the members agree that we'll give you the money. Being a multi-party democracy, we think even in our multi-party situation, we agree that health gives us hope that they're doing well. It's even worse when you've got this single dose drug. We're hoping that it is got to be a Mandela something, I don't know how to put it. But we're very hopeful that we're going to get there. And with Abo Ian doing what they've done with the money, that was worrying us. With the hopeful, with Abo Tiny sitting in Limpopo and trying to sort out things. And your whole team at the back there helping you. But even those who didn't talk, we thank you for not talking. But we know that you made sure that we keep to the time. Sausage. She says it's a defamation. I'm waiting for lawyers, organizing my lawyers to be ready. Good. So thank you very much, Department. Jürgen, thank you very much. You always impress us and continue doing that, even with this SAFM, because they always call it. Members, thank you very much. I think for this week, we are done. Enjoy yourselves. We meet next week.
Yeah, from the department.
By the way, there's lunch. Everybody is invited. It's not coming from your money. It's coming from our little money that we have. So we're inviting you for lunch. Everybody is invited. What were you saying, Georgie?
I was saying thanks to the chair and honorable members for the
support.
Right in line.